Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Thank you so much for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. We are coming to you, as always, from the back of Roberta's Pizza in a beautiful Bushwick, Brooklyn. Today, we are continuing our conversation with Karen Karp of Karp Resources, looking at building back better. Karen, welcome to the studio.
Thank you. Great to be back.
So today, we're going to be focusing a little bit on the role of philanthropy in relief post Superstorm Sandy, and we're joined in the studio by Claire Bernard, who is the president of Family Foundation. Claire, thanks for coming out today.
Thanks for having me.
And then we have Rick Luftglass, who's the director of the Laurie M. Tisch Illumination Foundation. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you. I love being in Bushwick.
Come on out to Bushwick. So, Karen, I thought we might start the show off by, just for folks who aren't super familiar with the project, can we just do like a brief recap before we tuck into the rest of the conversation?
Sure. Thank you. Build Back Better is an initiative to work to support small food businesses in communities, low-income communities that were also very hard hit by Superstorm Sandy, to, as they are, recovering from their physical losses and from their business loss, to have an opportunity to consider a different set of offerings, healthful, more fresh food offerings, which are sometimes very unavailable in those neighborhoods. And we were given some seed money by Claire's foundation to take a look at, is there a there? Do the businesses want to do this? Are there community-based organizations on the ground ready to support this change? And so we spent about 7 weeks doing this research from the beginning of December to the middle or third week or so of January. And we found that we think there really is a there. There are communities in New York City, particularly the Rockaways, that have been kind of left out of many of the food access and health initiatives that are going on in New York City, and they're kind of ready to go. They're ready for something new to happen and to really, really make their food community much better.
Yeah, I think that the work that you guys are doing really presents this interesting opportunity to strengthen the community resources. And the role of philanthropy is something that we're going to be coming back to throughout the conversation today. But before we kind of tuck into that, I want to get a sense, both from Rick and Claire, of how you define that. You know, if we're thinking philanthropy, you know, basically if you're at, you know, my second grade cousin's classroom, like, what are you telling her? Like, how do we understand what work your foundations do?
Well, if I was talking to a second grader, I'd explain to them that everyone can participate in philanthropy, that it's not some elitist word that cuts people out. But what we do as foundations is our foundation is self-funded, so we're not considered a charity. And we have several program areas, and we work with amazing partners who are nonprofits, charities, and work with them to support them and help them in any way we can, and mainly through grant making, sometimes consulting, sometimes just listening.
Excellent. Rick, anything to add to that for the Tisch Foundation?
Well, I think, and I'm not sure how this applies to second graders, but many people know of the Ford Foundation, Rockefeller, and Carnegie, and they think that's a foundation. I mean, it is a foundation, but there are thousands of smaller foundations like Claire's and ours that are on the ground giving grants, often to smaller grassroots organizations, because we are often in daily, hourly dialogue, and really identifying some of the gaps and some of the needs. And some of the smaller foundations like ours can be more nimble and flexible than the larger institutional foundations.
Yeah, I think that was something we definitely noticed here at the station, looking at response to Sandy directly in the aftermath, that there was a real need for a diversity of resources to make sure that people at all spaces in a community were getting serviced. And Karen, I'm wondering, because you guys have spent this time kind of doing the research on the ground, you've identified some of the needs, How have you found that you're looking to kind of different institutions or government for resources as you're looking to kind of go forward and implement some of the changes that your report, Build Back Better, has identified?
Right. Well, great question. I mean, when I first got the idea, and I should step back one step back. Part of what gave us the idea to do this is because of all the work that we've been doing with the New York City Green Card Initiative for the last 4.5 years, which is a program that has been funded by the Tisch Illumination Fund. And because we have staff on the street in these communities day in and day out working with street vendors whose whole purpose and job is to sell fresh fruits and vegetables in these communities, we had a sense of which communities were being served and not being served and which communities were really still not touched by the program for any number of reasons. So we kind of brought that sort of experiential knowledge to, well, let's move into the brick and mortar environment here. And that's how we got the idea of working with small groceries and restaurants and small supermarkets and the like. But my initial response was, I'm going to call up New York City's food policy coordinator, Kim Kessler. She's a friend of mine. This is what she cares about. And I'm going to say to Kim, I've got this great idea, which I said to her. She says, that is an amazing idea. And actually, she gave us the name. I had a much worse name because I'm terrible at naming things. And she said, yeah, what you're really trying to do is to understand how these communities can build back better. And I said, well, what support can the city lend to this? And she said, well, you know, EDC has their grant and their loan program that they're working through the small business centers throughout the city, and the small business centers are being set up. And we get on a conference call with the small business centers, and they're completely overwhelmed. This is early December, right? This is maybe a week after Thanksgiving. They're completely overwhelmed, and they just can't even handle the idea of a small entrepreneurial initiative that is an independent kind of thing. So they said, you know what, we can't be your partner. We think it's a really good idea. Come back to us. If you are able to do this, come back to us, and then we'll all be in a different place, and then let's see. And so we're in that place right now. We finished this phase, and we have some findings, and the city is also finding where they are able to be impactful and where they're not able to be impactful. And I think as we were talking before the show, one of the things that Claire noted, which is what we experience all the time, is the city has their rules, they have the people that they touch, and they have the people that they don't touch, not because they're not well-intentioned to touch those people, but because those people, if we're talking about small business people in these kinds of communities, they are immigrants, they're probably not speaking English, they might not have bank accounts, they might not be part of the formal economy, even if they own a small business. And so, A, they're probably not going to know that the city's out there to help them. And B, they probably don't consider themselves part of a class of people that can or should or would be helped by the city. So there's a real gap in making that connection between these sort of on-the-ground first responders, like a deli in your community is after something like Sandy.
But they also don't – sorry to pipe in. They also don't have any savings. They really run day-to-day. So if they miss a day – they're done, you know, and, you know, our first response was really to try to help small businesses and keep them going. And what was so sad and frustrating to find was that, you know, there were businesses to help, thankfully, but there were ones that were prepared, had some savings. And now it was, okay, we got to build back. We've got to, you know, stock up. How do we do that? And all the businesses that, you know, are really fundamental parts of communities, like the delis, because they're food sources in some of these communities, there were none of them left to help. They were gone.
So, Claire, your foundation has had some experience in disaster relief. I mean, you do work internationally, but also you were there post-Katrina. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, kind of takeaways from that experience that really identified, you know, pivotal funding points for your foundation that you're able to employ here with Sandy?
Yeah, you know, we started working in New Orleans after Katrina. So, you know, we respected the fact that we didn't have the connections and the knowledge base. And so our first kind of wave of grants were filling voids. Offices were damaged. They had to move. They had to buy new equipment. That's what we funded. And then as we really got immersed in the community and, you know, develop solid partners to work with and find ways to be helpful. It was interesting. A lot of it was in the food industry. New Orleans is based off a hospitality industry, and food is huge in Louisiana. But the things we really found can be applied, but not really can be applied. New Orleans is a different beast.
Yeah, Katrina was a different beast.
Yeah, and New York City, it moves quickly. And there is response, and they're listened to, they're heard. When they ask for something, they get it. So we spent, I would say, probably almost 10 years in New Orleans dealing with the after effects of Katrina, whereas I'm assuming in New York, we'll probably spend 3 years, you know, because the city can raise a ton of money, you know, Bloomberg's fund. So can the state. The federal government will give a lot of money. No one can afford for New York to be out of business. So it's a very unfortunate and geological issue.
So that brings up, you know, an interesting point with regards to, you know, what New York City is and kind of lessons learned. I mean, unfortunately, I think we can only expect to be confronting more of these climate-influenced challenges in the years to come. And
well, we are today with the tornadoes.
Yeah. I mean, as we sit in the studio. Yeah. Jesus. Rick, your foundation, you guys kind of took pause for a moment. I mean, you didn't jump in immediately in the aftermath of the storm, or maybe you did a little bit, but you kind of sat back to see, like, you know, what are the needs and where are we going to play the best role? Can you talk a little bit about that decision-making process and kind of at this point what you've identified as areas to focus on?
Sure. While we did do some immediate grant making for immediate needs, we made a commitment of $500,000 and said, but let's not spend it yet. We wanted to take a couple of months or more to really assess what the gaps are. As Claire indicated, you don't necessarily know right up front. You know, in Katrina and in New Orleans, you didn't necessarily know for a year, in some cases, what the gaps are. And it's taken many years to build that, and it's not all done.
And here, also, what you think they are is never, like, what you expect the gaps to be are never what they are.
Exactly.
They're complete surprises. You can't be prepared for them. You just have to give the time, you know, and listen to what the organizations need.
Exactly, exactly. So we basically, you know, when the superstorm hit, we started talking to people. We were listening. We talked to folks like Karen Karp and Karp Resources and a number of other advisors, and went out and were on the ground and learning from people like the green card vendors. What were they facing? You know, that's a hugely important example of the kinds of needs that you hit. Here were micro businesses on the street. If they're closed, if they're not selling, they're not making money. And if they're not making money, they can't feed their families. And one of the lessons that comes up in Katrina or with Sandy is that it's people who are living on the margins who are going to be tilted into high need categories, essentially. So if you're an hourly worker, if you don't have benefits, then, and you don't have savings, as Claire indicated, you have no resources to rely on. And we found green card vendors who were closed. I think about two-thirds of them were closed for over a week. Many of them were closed for two or more weeks. They had to close early for the season. They had, in some cases, $1,500 of inventory spoiled because they had bought it and couldn't sell. They didn't have gas to get to Hunts Point, where they often buy fruits and vegetables. They couldn't replace their inventory. All of these things create, and I don't think you could have expected this one day after, they created major business impediments that did not just affect someone for a few days, but had months of impact. And so you really had to step back and look at that.
So, Karen, you know, it sounds like, you know, one of the greatest currencies that you have post an event like this is information, both in the immediate aftermath, but then as we, you know, time passes and we're able to go back and take an assessment. And can you talk a little bit about, you know, when you were putting together the Build Back Better report, you know, who were the primary resources for that, and how challenging was it to find them? I mean, how sure are we that, you know, we haven't missed some some class of small businesses in the Rockaways in Coney Island.
Well, I'm pretty sure we have missed because there are so many small businesses in New York City. I mean, there are more than 20,000 small food businesses that are not restaurants in New York City. I think the number is 24,000 something. And so we're definitely not going to capture everybody. And that was really not the intention. We did, I will take your sort of suggestion of currency and raise it up a notch. It's not so much, it is information, but where that information comes from are the networks, the community that we have, the resources that are part of our larger food community network. So we did two things right away. Once we knew we had a little bit of time and money to kind of go and explore this, we did two things right away simultaneously. I sent two of my Green Cart employees, the project manager and a field assistant. I sent them on. They got in a Zip car and they drove around for 3 days. They went to Staten Island. They went to Red Hook. They went to the Lower East Side. They went to Coney Island. They went to Rockaways. I said, just drive around for a few days. Tell me what you see. I had already been to the Rockaways. I'd been to Coney Island. I knew what I saw, but I wanted them to see through their eyes of how they support small businesses, what was open, what was not open, et cetera, et cetera. They were doing that, and I pulled a network together of people that I thought could come together to provide the best kind of insight on what was happening on the ground and a way to approach what's going on. So we reached out to a couple of executive directors of community-based organizations that work particularly in Coney Island and the Rockaways. We decided after the Zipcar trip, we would focus on Coney Island and the Rockaways. So I got on the phone and I called up two executive directors that I happen to know through my network that are working on the ground there. And I said, what do you think about this? Can we come out and talk to you? And they both, for different reasons, said, yes, absolutely. We are really struggling here. I mean, in Coney Island, they lost their supermarkets. Rockaways, they had one supermarket. They lost that, but they rely much more, the area we were focused on the smaller businesses, on the small restaurants and small corner stores. So we went out and we spoke with them and we said, who is in your network? Who do you work with here? Are you working on food issues? One group was, one group wasn't. We ended up focusing a little bit more on the Rockaways towards the end where really there isn't enough going on to support a food infrastructure, a healthy food infrastructure. There are thousands of people. I think there are 8,000 people, maybe 6,000 people, somewhere between 6,000 and 8,000 people who live in one NYCHA complex. They were all reliant on one supermarket that still has not opened. It's May. It still has not reopened. What is happening to these people who were already so disenfranchised? So we went out and we did sort of a combination of business consulting and community, you know, community organizing. We went out and we gathered business. We identified businesses, business people. We interviewed them. We went to the community-based organization. We said, who's in your community? We went to a chamber of commerce type business associate, merchants association that wasn't really focused on our part of the Rockaways. Interestingly enough, they focus on the far east and the far west, but not in the center where all the food problems are. So that was new for them, that there was like a market there that they could be supporting. And probably most importantly, we worked with the community-based organizations, trained them, set up a survey, and had them survey, just walk around their neighborhood for a couple of weeks and survey as many small businesses as they could to get the firsthand information. We did those interviews in Chinese, Mandarin. We did them in Spanish. We did a few in French. So it was very important to have multiple language skills on the ground doing those interviews. And from that information, we have assessed that there are enough small businesses that just are sort of, they don't know where to turn, that they are open to doing things a little bit differently if they can get some of that help for free. What we did learn absolutely is they need a combination of philanthropy, grant money, as well as perhaps later down the line, some low interest loans, et cetera. They're not going to go right to the loan option because it's not their paradigm. And as Claire mentioned, they have no savings. There's nothing to base a loan on. So we took the community-based approach and the food network approach at the same time.
So at this point, you've identified essentially some next steps, some actionable mm-hmm. steps. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, you know, how throughout the implementation process you include community stakeholders in that process, especially because you're not just rebuilding. You're going to build it back better. So there's right. a change process that's happening there, which I think complicates things and necessitates like a more kind of collaborative
yep.
approach. So how are you kind of dealing with that? And then I guess to open it up, Karen, to the rest of the group, too, where does that like rank in the level of importance when you're looking at making funding decisions?
Yeah. Your question couldn't be any more timely, because the group that was supporting us and who did the surveys in the Rockaways, very great group, really interested in food, isn't really doing a lot with food. They came back to us after reading the report, and they gave us some things that they wanted us to correct, which we did. They wanted to be represented in a very particular way, and we did that. And we said, listen, we hope we can work on this going forward. We're waiting to hear about a little bit more seed funding to get a group of funders together to really do this. And I forgot to mention that the other people on my team were an architect and a food service equipment consultant. And so we brought them out to the communities to say, what would it look like and what would it really entail if this store were to build back better? Tell us what equipment we need. Tell us how much it would cost. And we did little business models that showed the profit and loss potential for putting one, two, or three pieces of new equipment that could sell fresh, healthier options. So I just wanted to mention that there was a little bit more rounded group on the professional side. But your question is timely, because the group that we have identified in the Rockaways to work with basically came back and they said, we love everything you did. Thank you for making those changes in your report. The next step is to engage the community. Before we can go one step further, we need you to come out and attend and facilitate at least one, if not two, meetings with our residents, meaning the residents in NYCHA housing, and let them know what you're interested in doing, and let them know why, and let them give their personal feedback as consumers in this community what they want to see. And the executive director of this group said to me, we're not going to commit to anything until our residents have the buy-in. It's their neighborhood, it's their power, it's their vision. So now the next step is to collect their vision before you can come back and work with us again. So it was not a suggestion.
Well, actually, maybe before we jump over to Rick and Claire, let's just we'll take just a quick break, and when we come back, we'll kind of continue this conversation on building it back better and the role of philanthropy. So hang tight.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Okay, so we are back talking about Build Back Better, taking a look in particular at the Rockaways. And so I wanted to turn it over to you, Claire and Rick, as people making funding decisions. You know, Karen's team at CARP Resources put together this comprehensive report. They are coming back to you like, you know, we did the report. This is what we found. This is how we're getting community buy-in. When you're looking at making funding decisions, I mean, how important is the fact that the community has been engaged? How important are having kind of other partners in the process? And as a funder, are you, you know, pretty hands-off or pretty hands-on when you're kind of pushing things in that kind of initial negotiation phase? And maybe, Claire, we'll start with you.
Yeah, there are notorious examples of funders and SCN. It's just kind of like airdropping solutions into communities. And without fail, those are the solutions that don't work. And people are like, oh, why? So the fact that there is community buy-in is huge. But then also, it can't just be one funder's idea. Because that, once again, is, well, one person believes it's right. You really need to have a team of people who are behind this and feel that this is the solution. So kind of the next step kind of on our side of it is, who else are you going to have fund this? Because we're definitely interested. You know, we wanted this research to be done. We want to know the next steps. And so we want to be part of the next phase. But you got to have other people as well. So once the kind of a group of funders is assembled, then the next phase takes place, which is really a trial. you know, is creating an example or two of this and see how it works out. And that usually is when the government money starts to kick in, or the city money, is because that's what they need. They need solid evidence. So that's really the beauty of what philanthropy can do, is that we can step in during that period of, what do we do? Is it going to succeed? And, you know, show it can or show it can't. Foundations have great flexibility, especially where Rick and I both work, to act quickly and to take risks. So,
yeah, Rick, you were mentioning that earlier with the fact, like, being nimble and being able to kind of step in and make a decision quickly. So I wonder, you know, for past projects that the foundation has supported, I mean, obviously you're learning as you go. So some takeaways that are things that now you're like, we're not getting involved unless we see X, Y, and Z. I mean, do you have those criteria?
It's always a balancing act, because you want to look at the track record and the history of success, what kind of ability to execute there is, whether it's an organization or any other entity. But then you don't want to be bound by that past experience. You want to identify, are there different ways of thinking about this? You can build back, or you can build back better. And so I think it does take a fresh look, but based upon a knowledge of what has or hasn't worked.
Yeah, that makes sense. So essentially, Karen, it sounds like then the next steps in the phase of this project are to get this community engagement, bring it back to the team, include it, and then is it a demonstration project? Is it a pilot? Like, what happens after that?
That's how we're looking at it. We've pretty much selected one very fast food restaurant, a Chinese fast food restaurant in the Rockaways, and a small deli that, to us, represent two really good examples of anchor food businesses in these communities, significant providers of food for people who live in the Rockaways. And what's interesting to us about working with a business like a Chinese fast food restaurant is there's this paradigm we have about in our heads, which is true, about Chinese fast food restaurants in low-income communities, right? They're yellow and red. They sell fried Chinese chicken and, you know, other kinds of fast Chinese food that, you know, is, you know, highly cooked, not highly processed necessarily, but not necessarily made with the most healthful intention. And after I saw this particular Chinese family just literally throwing all of their equipment out on the ground, you know, basically gutting their place, we sent one of my team members with who does speak Mandarin, but with someone who speaks Mandarin better than her, in there to speak to them. And they're like, yeah, we don't have anything. We've always thought about having a salad bar. So these community businesses are thinking about different offerings. Those are the businesses that we want. And the idea, as Claire mentioned, is to create an example, really support a couple of businesses to really create, really give them the support that they need. And we've seen that with green cards for years. You know, these disenfranchised business owners, they're on the outside of their community. They're not in the mainstream. They need a lot of handholding, and but they genuinely want to succeed. They are entrepreneurs at the truest sense of the word. They just rely on themselves to succeed. Give them as much support as we're able to give them. And then while we're doing that, build agency with government organizations here in New York, such as the Department of Health, such as the Food Policy Coordinator's Office. Bring the city agencies in to show that there is a real business case for healthy food. That's where I think we're going to be able to bring in SBA, you know, to bring in the Small Business Service folks and say, listen, you got to come and see what's happening here. These are real businesses, and there's thousands of them across New York City. But I think we need to demonstrate, take a little bit of a risk with a certain category of business owners that are just not in, you know, not in the mindset of how are those agencies going to get success. They're measuring their success on numbers of loans, numbers of grants, et cetera, where they can have the highest success record. And that's not with our group of business owners. So I think we're going to be trying to really bridge a gap and mainstream some of these small businesses in the minds of the city.
But I think you're drawing an important distinction. Traditional philanthropy is around funding nonprofits. It's not about funding businesses. It's not about looking at those businesses as part of a community infrastructure. And I think that Karen and Claire have hit upon a really important concept, and we've tried to do this with the Green Card Initiative too, which is looking at small business people as anchors and catalysts within the community. And they don't know how to write proposals. That's not what they do. They have to make money to feed their families. But in this context, in the Build Back Better context, they are trying to increase the ability to serve healthy food. And by doing that, they're becoming sort of accidental social entrepreneurs. They're not in it for the social purpose, but they value the opportunity to feed their communities with a healthier range of options. They understand there are gaps.
Yeah, well, and I think one of the interesting things, essentially just by virtue of your groups being there, you are kind of doing some part to build some infrastructure into that community to deal with, unforeseen things that may happen in the future. I'm curious because I know, in kind of business, and I'm assuming in philanthropy, the phrase, you know, what gets measured gets done. And so how are you, Karen, how are you anticipating that you'll measure success? And then conversely, what, I guess, would success look like, Claire or Rick, as from a funder's perspective? But Karen, we'll start with you.
Yeah, I mean, because we're focusing on business owners here, like we did with Green Cards, the measure of success is how successful can they be in their business with this new range of offerings. As kind of dry as that sounds, it is also very clear the P&L, the profit and loss, will measure the success. Can these folks prepare and sell healthy food and make a profit doing so? If they make a profit doing so, it proves out a couple of things. One, there's a demand for those products in these communities, which we've seen over and over again. There is a demand for healthier food in low-income communities. And also, can this business owner do a good job selling the stuff? Because it doesn't matter if they have healthy food, if it doesn't look good, if it doesn't taste good, if it's not portioned or priced correctly. So it's both things. It's kind of codifying the demand, but shoring up the supply so that it can meet the demand really in a business appropriate way, in a health appropriate way, in a delicious appropriate way. And this really speaks, Claire, to the question you asked me earlier, which is what do I see as the divide between business or the connection between business and nonprofit? And it's basically this: is that we love to work in that space where business can support a social or an environmental outcome, and with food there are so many opportunities.
So, Rick and Claire, I'm curious, from the funding perspective, are your measures of success kind of the same as the project or the person who's executing the project, or do you have additional ways that you feel successful in your positions?
I think it changes for us project by project, but in this case, it would really be if it activates larger funds, whether they're from the city, the state, or a large like foundation like Gates.
Might as well shoot for the moon.
Exactly. We all hope for Gates.
Bill, if you're listening, 718-497-2128.
They could do some grants too. Because with a lot of these larger organizations, for instance, with Gates, I speak to them, and they say, they're like, we can't do what you do. We can't do a $5,000 grant. We can't do it that quickly. And so that's kind of the sweet spot that Rick and I live in, which is this: we can do from 5,000 to 100,000. We can do it quickly, and we can also take risks. So for us, it's great. Two businesses up and running, doing a good job, doing better than ever, built back better. But is everyone jumping on the ship now? Are we going to see a greater rollout? And that's a lot of also, especially with my family's foundation, what we like. We like the points of the risk. We're willing to do their 10 projects, only one will work. That's fine. Let's find the one that works. And then let's get Gates to support it.
Yeah, no, I mean, you bring up an interesting point in that, like, even in the world of, foundations, and when you're in the position of you know, making grants and giving money away, that there's still, you still have a reputation to protect. And I don't know, Rick, if maybe you can speak that to a little bit, like when you're making those decisions, when you're looking at what success looks like, you know, that has to be a factor that plays into those things.
It is, and it's looking beyond, I mean, it, yes, it's case by case on a grant, but you're also looking at the whole range of what you're doing and looking at, are you spending money to have an impact, or are you just spending money? And so we look at a macro level, and so you can look at, for example, you know, what a business is doing on a very individual basis, but is it affecting quality of life or opportunity in the Rockaways or in Coney Island or in Red Hook? And so I think we look towards both the immediate impact, but what's the ripple effect? How do you ripple out? Now, honestly, that's one of the hardest things to measure. You know, there are so many other factors that come to play if you're talking about, for example, healthy food in a community. So we look towards a broader objective, but recognize that as an actor, you can only do very concrete things within that. And again, hope to bring other funders to the table, but you have to manage expectations in terms of what you can do in an immediate fashion.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, we are just about out of time. Karen, if folks want to get involved in the project, they want to follow the work, what's the best way for them to stay in touch?
They can stay in touch with us by sending me an email, Karen@carpresources.com, Karen with a K and Carp Resources with a K, and we can put people on our newsletter list. If we move forward with this project, I think we probably will end up setting up a website for it, so there's a kind of a central collective place to get people's ideas, raise some money, and move the project forward.
Awesome. Well, Karen, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Pleasure.
Claire, Rick, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
This program, like all 30 of our live weekly shows, are available for free as a download through iTunes. You can find us on Stitcher Smart Radio or visit the website, www.heritageradionetwork.org. We are a member-supported nonprofit organization, so if you like what you hear, and we think that you will, definitely click that Donate tab and become a member today. Thanks so much for tuning in, and keep on listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.